Hi everyone, you're listening to the Yacht Racing Podcast. I'm Justin Chisholm and my guest this time is British Serial America's Cup competitor Freddie Carr, who is about to take on his sixth campaign to try to win yachting's oldest and most prestigious trophy. Aside from his racing skills, Freddie has also carved out a sailing media career and is well known to sailing fans for his role as a mainstay of the Sail GP commentary team. We had a wide-ranging conversation that spanned Freddie's illustrious career in the America's Cup, his thoughts on Sail GP, plus a discussion on the relative merits of cycling versus grinding in the next America's Cup, and much more besides. Freddie Carr, welcome to the Yacht Racing Podcast. Lots of people will, of course, know your name from your America's Cup exploits over, I think, the last 20 years or so. But SailGP fans will also recognise your voice as part of the commentary team since that circuit began. Which are you most famous for these days?
Oh, I'd like to think the sailing, but for sure I get more comments when I'm around boat parks and at regattas. I definitely get more comments nowadays about my opinions on racing. And I seem to divide opinion with my SailGP commentary, which I'm happy to do, to be honest. I throw my opinions out there, right or wrong. And yeah, it's good fun. I've had a really, really interesting year doing SailGP season two.
And the fans don't hold back, do they, on social media?
No, they don't, actually. And one of our broadcast executives who's been in TV forever, a guy called Rick Dovey, said, whatever you do, guys, do your best show and don't read the comments on YouTube. So then what do? You read the comments on YouTube and boy, oh boy, you get brought back down to earth with a bump if you do that.
So yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it's been an interesting year.
I think perhaps what a lot of people don't realise is that you're not necessarily on site when you're commentating on these events, because SailGP are very big on saving resources, so they don't necessarily fly you out to all of these events.
Well, no, they don't fly us out at all. We sit in a broadcast studio in Ealing, the whole broadcast team, and we're in a booth next to the umpires, so the umpires aren't on site either, and we are commentating off the pictures that everybody sees. It's obviously supplemented with all the live data off the boats, which, as the analyst for me, is fantastic. I can really flesh out the pictures that we see and work with the graphic guys trying to display that to sailors and non-sailors alike. But it's not like we're on the floor at the regatta getting the vibes off the crew, which I would love to do. But I totally understand from like a sustainability point of view, not flying 40 people around the world to do a TV show is definitely a good thing.
Yeah, I think it's a tough gig, to be honest with you, commentating on an event remotely. I know that's how they do it a lot in the Olympics, and I've experienced that a little bit for myself. And it's really not very easy at all. So I think as you say, not being able to have a chat with the sailors about what's the latest new thing they're trying on the boats and stuff is makes it tricky for you.
Yeah, it does make it tricky, but we're lucky in the world of FaceTime and that kind of side of things that you can. But like myself and Stevie, my co-commentator, have good relationships with a number of people across all the teams, and we talk to them daily via WhatsApp or FaceTime or something. And they're well aware they're talking to commentators, so they don't give too much away. But the crews in general are really helpful trying to flesh out our story to make it a better product for everyone, which we're very grateful for.
One of the atmosphere at these events is great. I was just in one of the events recently for my first time, and I was just really impressed by how kind of relaxed everybody was, how much the sailors seemed to be enjoying the whole thing. Mm. And then one of them pointed out to me that, well, yeah, you know, because the boats are one design, we finish racing and we can have a beer and have a chat about it. We don't need to go into design meetings or modify anything or change anything other than the debrief. It's pretty much done for the day.
Yeah, and I think it's a reflection of probably the key players there. Obviously, there's a lot of key players in the moth class, and that whole moth culture of maybe shared learning. There's obviously not a lot of shared learning between the teams, but that culture that the moth class has developed in the foiling world, I think, falls over into SailGP a little bit, and it's definitely not the Olympic Games or the America's Cup in terms of absolutely shut the doors and don't let anyone into your tent. It feels to me like there is a good camaraderie between all the teams, but they haven't lost their competitive instincts, that's for sure, from what I hear as well. There's definitely a couple of teams that go the biff the whole time. So it's a nice mixture of super competitive sport and everyone trying to help everyone. It's good.
And shared data is interesting. I was a little bit skeptical about that, but I got the feeling from them that people do pore over the data from the other teams and try and understand what the little wrinkles are that they're doing maybe differently to what you're doing.
Yeah, the answers are there. The answers are there. The reason that the British team and particularly the Australian team might be quicker in the breeze, and the Australian manoeuvres, I think, are standout, and starting strategy, if you dive into the data, you can find out how to make your boat go faster. Whether you've got the skill to achieve that is another question, but the answers are all there. So a good coach that's willing to put the hours in to find the answers, and actually a dedicated sailing team that asks the right questions is going to go a long way. And it'll be interesting this year to see how quickly the two new teams with the Swiss and the Canadians get up to speed. There's no reason why they shouldn't be fast straight off the back because of that shared data ethos that goes around.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Do you think that's realistic that these guys can kind of come in, and I mean, they're not going to come in all guns blazing in the first event, I would imagine, but over the season, could they be podium contenders, do you think?
I would be surprised and really impressed if they're podium contenders. I mean, you look at the French from last year, and they made two final three races, which was it. So everyone can do it. The Spanish were leading after two events. So everyone at a Grand Prix can string five races together and get in with a shout of winning the overall event. Yeah, I think actually they probably stand a chance of maybe featuring in the final three in the latter end of the season. But if they were to make the final three overall, that would be some performance.
It's exciting stuff. And increasing the boats again this year, it seemed to me crowded with six boats on the race course because we're so used to watching the America's Cup boat-on-boat match racing. Then eight, now 10. That's going to be intense, isn't it?
Yeah, it's going to be full on, actually. We had a good few dings last year, didn't we? Particularly start line into Mark 1, into the bottom gate there where everybody comes together. And you've just got to think that with two extra boats, two boats kind of learning the ropes a bit more, it's going to be all action, isn't it? It is going to be all action. And I think the Australians did well last year because I can't really recall any big moments where they were caught up in any of the big incidents. So more than ever in season three, I would imagine if you sail clean and actually avoid the traffic, you should be in good shape come the end of the season. And they obviously did it by avoiding the traffic, by starting well and staying out in front. So easier said than done.
I mean, at the last event in San Francisco, I asked a question at the final press conference about, we saw some pretty dangerous situations on over the 2 days of racing there, particularly that, I thought, you know, boats landing on other boats is always... it's always the opportunity to hurt somebody quite badly. And the incident with the French and the Kiwis and you know, even Ben screaming across their bows, that's pretty close stuff. Do we need to keep them further apart? That was the question I asked at the press conference.
Yeah, that's a good question. Interestingly, I was at a regatta last week and I had a long conversation with Nathan Hislop, a Kiwi guy who's very senior in the safety side of things, work for SailGP in the safety side of things. And there are conversations going on right now about how to put more safety stays on the boat. So not stays to necessarily hold a performance enhancing and change the wing setup or anything like that, but just more stays coming off the wing to protect the crew. See it as a halo in Formula One. So not performance enhancing at all, but just putting more stuff on the boats for the protection of the crew, and actually retraining the crews rather than when an incident's about to happen, everybody tries to jump out of their cockpit and get into the middle of the trampoline, which is actually when they're at their most vulnerable, what you need to do is hit the deck and get completely out of the way and don't expose your body. So just changing a little bit of a mindset. But yeah, Justin, I think it's like all sports. And I mean, the easy comparison is motorsport, isn't it? I mean, I watch some of those things go on, particularly on the street circuits, you know, when they're doing close to 200 miles an hour next to a wall. And that blows my mind. And actually, it's where the sport is. And I believe SailGP and the America's Cup are doing a good job of keeping it safe.
Yeah.
As safe as they can, yeah.
Tom Slingsby gave a great answer to my question, which was that the way SailGP works is that the all of these incidents are reviewed by a panel, which includes several of the skippers. And, you know, if the organisers, if everybody feels, yeah, this is too dangerous, we need to change something, it can be changed for the next event.
Yeah, and it's really easy. You said keep the boats apart. I mean, that's quite simple in terms of the shape that the boats sail in that the umpires see. All you have to do is increase that shape by, let's say, another 2 meters, and it just discourages engagement at any level. Now, don't get me wrong, if someone's out of control, they're out of control. But if there's an incident because someone's pushing a rule, then that's really, really easily changed.
It's all good stuff. Which would you rather be doing, Freddie, commentating or racing with them?
Do you know, you can't beat a good day on the water, but this year I just turned 40 and running across a trampoline, exiting Mark 1 into a boundary at close to 50 knots. I think those days are behind me, and I've really, really enjoyed watching the sport and learning a new skill in the TV booth. So I'm actually going to say probably for the first time ever, I've enjoyed commentating this time around.
Just to finish off on SailGP, at least for a little while, I was amongst the skeptics about it when it started. I couldn't see how it could possibly work, but I've got to say, having been to an event and seen it in full flow, it's pretty impressive, and it looks like the real deal, and it feels like it's got a lot of legs.
Yeah, Russell's got the formula right, hasn't he? That's the fundamental. I was a bit worried. I used to do the Extreme Sailing Series in the Extreme 40s for sort of 5-6 years, and you would have 6 races a day over 3 or 4 days. I can't remember. And basically through the chaos of stadium racing there, through Mark Turner's vision, the craziness sorted itself out and the best team still won. And I was a bit worried with only 5 races to get into the podium race, you wouldn't really have the opportunity for the cream to rise to the top. But I think over the course of the season, you actually see the best teams in the final, the teams that avoid the mistakes. So, the formula really works. And the big thing for me is, and then you can probably hear in our commentary, because we get a lot of feedback off sailors about it, is I want this to work for a non-sailing public. I want my friends from university, my friends from my local village to sit down and watch 90 minutes of sailing and go, oh my goodness, that is cool. Now, don't get me wrong. I know that it annoys people that we talk in kilometers an hour, not knots. I totally get that. But my mate Paul from down, who I have a beer with down the pub, has got no idea of what a knot is. But when he hears boats going 100 kilometers an hour, it blows his mind. So I think with SailGP, I hope there's something that sailors love, and I'm sure they do, but we need to use this amazing platform to show off our sport to the world. So that's why the commentary is slightly dumbed down every so often. But yeah, like I said, we get plenty of feedback about that on YouTube.
Yes, you do. That you're never short of everybody's opinion, for sure.
No.
Do you think SailGP has, and the success of SailGP has kind of thrown down the gauntlet for the America's Cup people? And I mean this in a positive way, that, you know, they need to kind of step their game up to be at least as exciting as this now.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think there's a world where they both live and they're both equally as successful. And I actually, that will happen, because the America's Cup is still the America's Cup, and you could never take away the prestige and the history of that event. And it is kind of, in my opinion, in terms of boat performance, stepping up, and definitely, I believe from what I've seen, will be a step on again from New Zealand, and to see a 75 foot, 70 plus foot monohull going round blows my mind. The grandeur of that boat is proper, and the Formula of Sail GP is great as well. But I'm sure there's plenty of people in America's Cup world watching Sail GP going, right, there's the line in the sand. What can we do in terms of an event, in terms of a venue in Barcelona, in terms of a TV production, and in terms of the protocol that is going to make this racing as exciting as that? And it's a challenge because Sail GP have done a very, very good job.
Yeah, I think it's exciting. And what I'm hearing is that perhaps the America's Cup World Series events will be, I think the quote in one of the New Zealand newspapers was a bit less of a kind of crash, bang, wallop and out again. There'll be longer events with a bit more substance to them, which I think will be good.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a huge sports fan and I love my cricket, and I see Sail GP and I see 2020 cricket like crash, bang, wallop. Like, this is absolutely full adrenaline and hitting six, hitting four, or you're out or something like that. And I just think the America's Cup, no, it's not quite test cricket. It definitely used to be test cricket, but it just has a bit more prestige about it, and it comes up for air, and it just has a grandeur about it that I don't think can ever be replicated. So if they get that right and keep that formula going within the Cup world, it's going to be a phenomenal event, I'm sure.
All right, we'll come back to a bit of America's Cup stuff later on, but I wanted to just get a feel for your career. I know something about it, a little bit about it. I usually ask people, do they come from a sailing family? but I know the answer because I met your dad on numerous occasions. So just tell us about your dad and his role, very important role in British sailing.
Yeah, so dad was a coach with the British Olympic sailing team for years, and then went on to manage the British Olympic sailing team, and then went on to work for the British Olympic Association and UK Sport. So he's kind of done the whole journey from being a coach of, now let me get this right, I think he was Soling Stars Finns back in the games that they didn't go to in 84 because of the boycott, but certainly, was that 84 or 80? I can't remember. But certainly Seoul 88 and then Barcelona 92. And then in 96, he was head of the Olympic team. And in 2000, he was deputy chef de mission of the whole British Olympic team. So second in charge of the whole British Olympic team. And that, for me, watching your old man walk out in the Olympic stadium behind Matthew Pinson waving the flag, was a proper proud moment. So, that's dad. And some of my earliest memories of professional sailing was when I was sort of eight, nine, 10, sitting in ribs with him in my summer holidays at Spa Regatta at Hyères, and watching Paul Brotherton and Andy Hemmings and Chris Law in the Soling. And we'd push off the dock at like 10 in the morning and be back at 6 at night, and just being in the rib with dad as he was coaching and talking to these people. So, I mean, what a schooling for me, to be honest, at the age of 8, 9, 10, being in that environment is probably more than I will ever know, put my head in the mindset that I live in today within the sailing world, and learning off these amazing sailors and listening to my old boy chat to them and debrief. And I guess I've been living in that sailing briefing, performing debrief world for 32 years. So extremely lucky.
Before you were even really aware of it, I mean, that is an amazing immersion. I guess it was inevitable you would become a professional sailor.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I felt like all things in life, I felt the cards fell in my favor. You needed a bit of luck. You needed to win some regattas. You needed the right doors to open. And certainly my bit of luck and the right regattas were in 1999, myself and Mark Campbell-James and James Ward won the Youth Match Racing Worlds down in Auckland, beating all comers. Actually, had a very successful year. And then spoke to Ian Walker as GBR Challenge started. And I said, look, Ian, this is where I'm at. I'm a young match racer, just won the Worlds. I don't want to go sailing. I just want to come and be involved in your team and sweep the sail loft and do all of this. So that was the door that he said, absolutely, come along. You're not going to sail. You're going to sweep the floor and be the nipper. And man, was I the nipper. Talk about an old school kind of rite of passage that I had with those amazing British sailors in 2001. And that was it. That opened the door. And then a couple of injuries going into the America's Cup Jubilee in 2001. And I found myself on the A boat racing against Prada and Team New Zealand, having only just watched those teams race for the America's Cup 12 months previously. So if I was going to say a period in time that set me up, it was that year to win the Youth Worlds, watch the America's Cup match between New Zealand and Prada in 2000, and then a year later be racing them in Cowes at the Jubilee. Was my never look back moment for sure.
it's just such a heady story, isn't it? It's almost a movie script where you'd say, yeah, that's a bit too.
If it, when I was saying it then, it sounded a bit far fetched. But I was going to race on the B boat in that America's Cup Jubilee, and it was the Fastnet maybe 2 weeks before. And big Guy Reid, big Scottish guy, absolute legend of a bloke, brilliant grinder. Did the Fastnet on a TP52, and he took it upon himself to grind all the way back downwind from Fastnet Rock to Plymouth, like on the handles for days, let's say. And he gave himself a shoulder injury, and God bless him, that was the shoulder injury that put me on the A boat as an 18-year-old. and that was the, so Guy Reid's shoulder, I think I can safely say, is the thing that set me up. So thanks, Guy, for getting that injury.
Oh, dear. Now, listen, I know you're a massive sports fan generally. So were there other sports that were competing with sailing, even though you came from this kind of, you know, amazing sailing family?
Yeah, no, I'm tall enough. I'm 6'3", and mum and dad were really, because I came from such a sailing family, dad didn't push me at all. In fact, he was anti. He kind of didn't get involved in my sailing at all. He wouldn't take me to any regattas. And if I wanted to do it, it was all up to me and me asking mum. And we'd chuck my topper on my mum's Citroen 2CV and drive from the south coast up to North Berwick, which took us about 2 days. And mum was so nervous about the topper blowing off, she strapped it down so hard in the summer heat that I put a warp shape in the bottom of my hull. So that was the kind of stuff we were up to. And I was super grateful because I played hockey, I played basketball, I played football, I played rugby. I took my basketball to a reasonable level. And then at about 16, I mean, I was never going to do anything with my basketball, but we used to get to the quarterfinals or the nationals every year, go up to London and get absolutely trounced by the London kids and go home with our tails in between our legs. But I'm really glad I wasn't just a sailing kid. I think it makes you well more well-rounded when you're in big sports, America's Cups and TP environments.
I read somewhere that you kind of went up through Optimist, then Toppers, then Lasers, and, you know, single-handed boats, obviously. Mm. And when you started match racing, it kind of all clicked into place. The idea of sailing with a small team, with a team of guys, this is what I need to be doing.
Exactly. And it was the late, great Andrew Simpson, we're both Hailing Island sailing club members. And he used to coach me during the winter. And I remember him going, look, Freddie, you're good. I'd come like top 10 at the nationals in a laser, maybe top 5 at the youth nationals. So I was reasonable, but not brilliant by any stretch, and miles off Olympic level. And Bart just said, look, man, like you, if you want to do this in a different vein, have a look at the youth keelboat squad and the youth match racing. And I think I was only 15 at the time. And I jumped into a first class 8, and having never flown a spinnaker or anything like that, but just my first day of sailing with 3 other guys on the boat, in a team environment, I was like, this is me. This is what sailing is going to be to me, being a crew member. So good old Bart, God rest his soul. That was some of the best advice I've ever got. He was basically said, look, you're a bit crap at this laser stuff. You should go and do something else, I reckon.
Now, you had a stab at the Olympics with Andy Beesworth in the Star. Talk us through how that kind of came about.
That was brilliant. I sailed with Andy at GBR Challenge in the 31st America's Cup in Auckland in 03. And we got on very, very well. And rolling out of that, he had obviously been ranked world number one in the soling, went into the games in Sydney as world number one and didn't perform, bless him. And I think he was fourth in 96 as well. So he definitely had unfinished business in the Olympics. So we bought Ian Walker and Mark Cavell's silver medal winning boat from Star from 2000. And we said, right, 2 years, let's go. Now, bearing in mind that Ian Percy, and it wasn't Bart at that time, it was Stevie Mitchell, were campaigning the Star. We gave ourselves 2 years to become top 10 in the world, and more importantly, beat those guys. And we won some events. We won races in Bacardi Cups, and we would finish top sort of 10 at Europeans. And we went into the Europeans in 2005 and said, right, for us to continue going, we need to come top 10 at this Europeans, and we need to beat Ian Percy. And Ian won with a day to spare, and we finished ninth. And we just had to be really honest. And we knew we were good. We knew that we were moving in the right direction. But when you're trying to surpass a talent like Ian, and he obviously went on to win gold in that cycle with Bart. In fact, one of my favorite moments to watch on telly ever, Bart punching the deck as he crossed the finishing line. It was a man, I learned a lot off Andy, and he still is one of the best small boat keel sailors in the world with what he's done in the Dragon and the Etchell. And boy, oh boy, did I learn a lot of Andy Beesworth about how to set up a small keel boat in those 2 years. Very grateful.
So I think it was around the time that campaign came to an end that the Extreme Sailing Series suddenly was created. And you know, we have to give kudos to Mark Turner for creating grandstand sailing, really, because I don't think before then there really was anything that was like that. And you were pretty early into all of that, weren't you?
Yeah, I was. I mean, I finished the America's Cup in Valencia in 2007. And got a call off Mark saying, look, we're beginning to start this up. We're looking for some big chaps to do the bow and pull code zeros or spinnakers up and down and jibs in and out. And I said, oh, yeah, catamaran sailing, never done that, but I'll give it a go. And then we went to a lake in Germany for the first event, and there was like six or seven boats. And the amazing thing there was it was run by OC Challenge, OC Sport, I can't remember what they were called. A very small group of really motivated people, and all of the teams would help rig and de-rig the boats, and then we'd go and help build the tents and the hospitality area. And just the sense of camaraderie around the early Extreme Sailing Series days was unbelievable. And very, very early on realized that stadium racing, for all of the naysayers saying 15 minute races a day is a nonsense, what are you doing, racing in city venues is a nonsense, I was like, nah, this is brilliant. And it culminated with Russell Coutts watching the event in Cowes after they'd won the Deed of Gift match in 2010 2011, I can't remember, and him going, right, that's us, and the rest is history. And I doff my cap to Mark Turner for the effort he put into the Extreme Sailing Series. And I doff my cap to Russell for going up onto the green one afternoon and going, right, that's the future of sailing. And those two chaps have kind of changed the sport forever, for sure.
It was a kind of fortuitous move into that. It was catamarans, which I don't think you'd done a lot of before. No. And it lined you up nicely when Russell said, well, we're gonna put the cup in multi-hulls, because you were sitting there, I think you'd just won. You just won the Extreme Sailing Series.
That's right. I mean, we were really lucky. We won with Oman Sail, with Chris Draper driving and Pete Cummings and Mark Bulkley and Nasser Al-Mashari helping us out and doing bow. And we were super lucky with that Oman Sail project. And as you said, really fortuitously, it's like, oh, the America's Cup's in catamarans. And then it was, had a conversation with Max Serena, the syndicate head of Prada, and the stars aligned again. I guess that was another one. If I looked at my youth worlds into signing with GBR Challenge and Guy's injury, that was the next one, winning the Extreme Sailing Series. And before I know it, I'm pulling on a Prada t-shirt, which was a pretty special moment to 10 years previously to see them race in the America's Cup match, to then be pulling on their sailing shirt was a pretty special moment as well. So yeah, very lucky the stars aligned there.
That's a pretty intense syndicate, pretty intense from the leadership down, very passionate, passionate fans, very passionate team. How did you fit into all of that?
How did I fit in? I'd like to think well. I got on really, really well with all the Italians, and they were a fantastic group to work with. Like the energy, as you said, Justin, the energy and around that group is phenomenal, and that's why they've been ever present in America's Cups. You know, the energy and the togetherness in that team was brilliant. It's a very different style of team to certainly the British teams I've been involved with and the Swedish team that I was involved with. Doesn't mean it's right or wrong. It's just different. There's a very passionate speech most days, which is I kind of enjoy. I'm a passionate chap myself. And yeah, it was a lot of fun. And the World Series events in Naples, of which we won the first one, there was 200,000 people on the shoreline watching us win that. And we left the compound having won that, and we were getting our jackets ripped off our backs as we were trying to walk to the stage. You know, I've never seen anything like that in my life, the love for Luna Rossa in that country. And that's great because it means that the whole nation, particularly after the last cup, are still so super engaged in America's Cup world. It was a privilege to be a part of it.
We need this, I think, in sailing, in professional sailing. We need these big syndicates to survive and do well. The Emirates Team New Zealand's, the Luna Rossas,
the Alinghis. The Alinghis are back. That's exciting.
Exactly. Because I think that is the future, and it gives the whole thing a credibility, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you look at the big football teams, let's say, or the big Formula One syndicates. People, if you're there for a long time, people go on the journey and build the personalities and you build the team. And actually, more importantly, what I found is you build the culture. It's all about the America's Cup is about culture and how that team lives and reflects and works together. And if you get that culture right and it transfers down into the kind of wider sporting ethos, then you're onto a good thing. And Alinghi, I mean, everyone that works for Alinghi in that 2003-2007 campaign still talks about the culture. New Zealand's got the culture that blows my mind, the All Black culture, I guess you'd say. And Luna Rossa, likewise, has their quirky culture, which is brilliant for them. And I actually, through going into the third cycle with the British team, the culture and the energy there is proper. It's very nice. So long may that continue.
So let's talk about that move to the British, because you had a chance, I think, if I read your profile right, you had a chance to stay with Luna Rossa. You had a contract in place, but then Ben rang you and said...
Yeah, but I mean, it was the end of 2013, and I'd re-signed to go with Prada again, which was fantastic. And it was very supportive of Max to sign me up before the previous America's Cup had finished, and we'd won the World Series with them. So I kind of feel like we'd earned it. But at the end of 2013, there was an opportunity to... Ben rung me up and said, look, there's an opportunity here. Would you be willing to risk it? And it's an absolute no-brainer, isn't it, to go and represent your country with Ben, who is a good mate, and with some people that I'd come up growing up sailing with. So yeah, I mean, there was no money in place. We were definitely just BAR, Ben Ainsley Racing. We certainly weren't Land Rover BAR, sponsored by 11th Hour and BT Sport and all of the stakeholders that got involved. So it was a proper punt, and there were some really shaky months. And I remember talking to Giles Scott on the phone, because he had had an opportunity to sign with Oracle. And he was like, look, Freds, what do you think? Is it going to get off the ground? And I was like, mate, I couldn't tell you. But one thing is for sure is I could not be sailing on an Italian boat if there was a boat out there with the Union Jack at the top of the wing. So I'm willing to take that risk. And here we are, sort of three cycles later. So the right call.
I was quite a leap of faith.
It was.
I'm interested in your relationship with Ben, because I know that Ben was one of the Ben's medal winning activities out in Savannah, I'm going to say. His first medal, anyway, was one of the things that kind of inspired you as a youngster.
Yeah, no, it was. And I remember watching his, I mean, I'm not sure if it wasn't a medal race then, his final race against Scheidt when they were going downwind and he got pipped for the gold. And just watching that as a 14-year-old going, holy smokes, this guy is wired up differently. And I actually watched, because of Dad's involvement with the Olympic team, I watched the trials in 95, the Brute Faberge trials in 95 in Weymouth, where there would have been close to 60 lasers trying to get that one spot. And watching Mark Littlejohn, Paul Goodison, Andrew Simpson, Ian Percy, obviously Ben, all trying to get that one spot. That's what really opened my eyes, actually watching that trial. And then, yeah, was super lucky to sail with him, started sailing with him in Keith Mills' team Origin, straight out the back of the 2007 Cup that got curtailed because of the Dido Gift match, which was a great shame because we had the very best of young British afterguard with Ben, Ian and Bart and the likes of myself and Chris Brittle. And then we had a smattering of America's Cup Hall of Famers from Alinghi and old school team New Zealand. And with no disrespect to people I've sailed with in the last sort of 15 years, that sailing team was right up there, right up there. That was a very cool team to be involved in.
And of course that was truncated by the court case and ultimately the deed of gift match. So that it never got to race, right?
Never got to race. We did an exhibition race in 2011. In fact, the same time that Russell walked up the green and watched the Extreme Sailing Series, he was in town because he ran Oracle then. He was in town because we did the 1851 Cup, which was Keith's way of building interest in the America's Cup. And we had two version 5 boats and we had a week-long match racing event against Oracle and we beat them up. They beat us in some old school nonsense race around the island, but there you go. They can have that one. On the Windward Leewards, we absolutely beat them up. And I joke with anyone who will listen, who's not a lot of people, is that it's the week that changed the sport, because as Origin, we beat Oracle in old school match racing in monohulls, big slow monohulls. And at that same time, Russell walked up the green and saw the Extreme Sailing Series and, yeah, no one listens to me, but I claim it's the week that changed the sport.
It's a good case for it. Now, listen, you bring up a good point. Those America's Cup, what were they called? International America's Cup class yachts. They're pretty spectacular to watch. You've sailed those. You've sailed the AC-72s. You sailed the AC-50s, and now you've sailed the AC-75s. So you're in a good position to comment on this ongoing, it's not even an argument, it's just a split in the fans between those who think foiling boats in the America's Cup is absolutely the way forward, and then those who would have us back in J-class boats because they want to see, you know, crew action, they want to see people pulling sails up and down. I can see both sides of the argument, but you've been in all of those different classes. So just give us your feel for it all.
Oh, God, that is, as you say, it's the absolute million dollar question. I've loved them all. I feel super privileged to kind of have a foot across 20 years and have been on the journey from IACC class boats into the AC-75s. The foiling at high speed is like turning downwind, a memory that will live with me forever. Is racing on course C in the last America's Cup against Prada and turning downwind right under Diamond Head, not Diamond Head, that's Hawaii, North Head, hitting 50 knots and hearing 4,000-6,000 people cheering is just mental. That is just mental. And you jibe on boundary right next to a spectator fleet that's going bananas. That's really cool. So in terms of a sporting contest, that's really cool. In terms of the beauty of sailing an IACC class boat with 16 guys that have to be in absolute perfect harmony to pull off maneuvers, that is very, very special as well. But I always go a little bit left field with my very favorite America's Cup boat that I've ever sailed is the World Series boat from the Bermuda Cup, the foiling 45 footers with the wing. Now, the reason I love those boats is because it wasn't about power production, be it grinding or cycling as it may well be. It was all about ropes and top handles and winching and jammers. And you had to be incredibly fit, a really smart sailor, know your way around the race course in terms of tactics, think for yourself, work beautifully as a crew. The boundaries were a little bit wider on the upwind when we weren't foiling. So it is a very tactical game upwind. And then it was all about kind of code zero decision downwind, getting on the foil. And those boats just, for me, they sat in a perfect place in the evolution of America's Cup, where it rewarded really good sailors, but you still had the absolute beauty of these 45-foot boats coming out the air and coming out the water, sorry, and foiling at sort of 40 knots. So those boats hold a very special place in my heart for sure. It rewarded being a great sailor with the old school coordination needed in a crew that you got from the IACC and the Instagram generation of foiling.
So I think maybe we'll see some of that with the AC40s that the Kiwis have introduced for this next cup. Not great for you guys as grinders, because I don't think there are any other.
No. That's going to be battery powered. I believe that's 4 people on board. And I think the performance of those 40 footers will be phenomenal. Really, really will be phenomenal. I haven't dug too much into kind of the VPPs of the boat, but I'm going to enjoy watching that for sure. That's going to be good sport.
For sure. All right. I want to dive in with you on the whole grinders and cyclers for this next cup. It's already created quite a lot of chat and opinion on the whole thing. I think from my point of view, when the New Zealand team turned up with people on bikes, I was just blown away by the audacity of it and the innovation of it, which was fantastic. By the end of the cup, I was kind of over it. I just felt it didn't look like sailing, particularly with these guys perched up in the air doing it. But it's going to be a no-brainer, isn't it, for this next cup? Now they've allowed it back in.
Yeah, I mean, you just have to look at the human performance side of things. It's a, call it 15 to 20% power gain using your legs over your arms. And potentially, well, not potentially, we're sailing with less people, only 8 people on the crew, down from 11. Only 4 of those 8 are able to produce the power. So, I mean, I'm not going to say too much, but it would be fairly obvious that you need to produce more power of less people. So,
yeah.
And if you go on everybody's Strava, the fitness measuring app, you'll see that there's lots of grinders from the old America's Cup doing a lot of miles on the road on their road bikes at the moment. So I'll let you join the dots.
Yeah, for sure. And we had your colleague Matt Gottrell on the podcast a few weeks ago, and he, you know, of course, he's gone from being a rower. He's changed his body shape so many times between rowing and sailing. Now he's onto the legs again.
He's just got to figure out what he wants to do, old Matty, doesn't he? Love him. I mean, wow, what a top boy. Won an Olympic gold medal in Rio, as I know. I listened to that pod, and he's a top man. And he came and joined us at Ineos in the last cup, and just brought another level of high performance mentality that transcended for our squad. And as a result of Matt joining us, we all got fitter again, because we're all trying to beat him, and all he was resetting the bar and a brilliant guy to have in squad. And he's a handy sailor, very handy rower, handy grinder, and I think he might be fairly nifty on the bike from what I can see as well.
He certainly looks like, if you're going to design somebody, he would look like both of you do, tall and big levers on you for sure.
Definitely helps.
Now, listen, we've talked about whether it's going to be cyclers. It seems like it's a no-brainer. It's going to be cyclers.
Yeah.
How does that change your role on the boat as a grinder? Because I think the grinding role is kind of misunderstood at times, in that it would be easy just to imagine it's just a grunt thing. It's just a turn the handles as much as you can. And we hear these stories about people blacking out on the, you know, during races and that sort of stuff. But I know from listening to you in other interviews, there's a lot more to that role than just that.
100%. The evolution of the grinder, as I've been involved, is on the IACC class boats, you needed to be a superb or a good match racer, particularly pre-start, to know where to put your power and work with the trimmers beautifully to power up the boat. And then you needed to have a bit of grunt about you for the tacking jewels and thinking ahead for what you might do at Windward and Leeward Gates and stuff like that. But fundamentally, power production, a good sailor, and able to think with a match racing mindset. Now, in the last cup down in Auckland, we had 5, sometimes 6 people grinding. Now, we did a really good job of integrating those grinders into doing something on the boat to unload the back of the boat. And it's not just a case of gritting your teeth and going max heart rate for 20 minutes. It's actually about getting to the point that you get your fitness to a point where you can produce the massive amount of power to power the boat, the hydraulics, but stay present in your head to think about the race, to engage in the race, to control potentially the part of the boat that you are in control of. I can't talk about this time round, but last time round I did the runners from my grinding pedestal, which I think was the second most trimmed function on the boat behind the traveler. And I had all of my data in front of me and I had to go and sit just at my top of my lactate threshold, which I got to know very well through the 3 years of training and trim the runners like billy-o. Not only for performance gains, as we all know runners do on any boat, but also if I got it wrong by 1.5 tons at the Windward or Leeward mark, we'd snap the wing in, the rig in half. So there was plenty going on. So yes, there could be some people who shut their eyes and absolutely sit at max heart rate for the length of the race. But I'd imagine, and I hope, that there's still opportunities for a sailing brain to help get the boat around the course as well as produce the power. And I agree, it's going to look a little bit odd on bikes.
Yeah. But I wonder whether we'll even be able to see you. Obviously, you can't really talk about this particularly, but I imagine you guys are going to be pretty low down in the boat, aren't you?
Yeah, we are. Do you know, I was out in St. Bart's last week racing on a TP52 and rubbed shoulders with grinding legends of the past that I won't go into who they were because they haven't given me permission to offer their opinions. But it's safe to say there's really mixed feelings about what the person that produces the power, we can't really call him a grinder anymore, looks like now. There's a strong opinion that just chuck batteries on and be done with it. And I understand that point of view as well. There's a strong opinion that we should just stick with grinding. Why change from grinding? Because that is traditional sailing and sailing as we know it. And I understand that. For me, as long as there's an athletic side to the America's Cup, that I think the cup needs to do a better job of exposing and showing what the grinders, cyclers are up to, there's a really good story there. And the America's Cup is always won by the fastest boat. We know that, but the fastest boat is there because of good tactics, because of fast trimmers, and because of fit crews. And I think if we lose the athletics side of things within the sport, it just takes away from what the sport is. And I would say that because I've been grinding for 20 years, but I also totally see the old school guys who are just saying, just be done with it and chuck batteries on. I think one of the lads said to me last week, it gets his goat that someone will potentially win the America's Cup in 2.5 years time that's currently never stepped foot on a boat.
I can
see that as well. It's not like sailors can go and win a gold in beach volleyball anytime soon.
Yeah, but we've seen it before, haven't we? We've seen hockey players, we've seen American footballers on boats, we've seen rugby players grinding on boats. It's not that much of a surprise.
It's not a surprise, and I think one of the better grinders, certainly from my point of view, through my generation, that's graced the sport was Rob Waddell from Team New Zealand, and he was ahead of the curve in terms of his fitness and his approach to grinding. So I'm not knocking it. It's just a bit of a funny quirk of the America's Cup, isn't it?
There must be some of the old Sky cyclists, the Ineos cyclists, eyeing up your job, are they?
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure. And God, I'd imagine. I mean, again, I'm not giving too much away, but you've got to look everywhere. I mean, the team is looking for some big, old, powerful units. Like some of the wattages that are being banded around are eye-watering. It's certainly going to take me the best part of 2 years to hit my targets. And I'm sure there's 90 plus kilo people out there now who are a good 15 years younger than me that are a step ahead. But I know how to plug a jib in and do all of that stuff as well. So hopefully that counts for something.
That's right.
Not that we'll be plugging a jib in during the race. That would be bad.
No, for sure. But listen, the hardware that you guys will be riding, I mean, there's massive amounts of opportunity for development on that, isn't it? I mean, we say they're on bikes, but they're not necessarily a bike, are they? It's a means of turning those handles. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, the human performance side of things in the last three cycles has stepped up and up and up. It's phenomenal, the lifestyle. I mean, I going into the cup in Bermuda, where we realized that you basically were becoming an endurance athlete. The shift in mindset I had to have as a 32-year-old then, and now, like I said, eight, 9 years later, still maintain that late arrival as trying to become an endurance athlete is quite something. Don't get me wrong, in between America's Cups, I can still put on a good 15 kilos and hold my own in the beer tent in Cows Week, but to shift it is a little bit harder. But yeah, the human performance side of things is huge. How our head of human performance, Ben Williams, for the last 8 years has called us athletes, which kind of rankles me because I'm still a sailor, but he calls us athletes and he's actually right. He's actually right in what you are nowadays. And I think probably over the last 3 years, more so going into this cycle, there is going to be the performance half of the boat where the super, super talented guys trim, foil, drive, and I hate to say it, the athletes up front. And then everything around how you package those people is going to be huge. Like in all, we did a massive amount of ergonomics grinding, and you got your crank height too high or too low, and it could be percentages of performance. So that level of detail will continue, I'm sure.
And that will now be applied to the saddles and the pedals and the whole thing, right?
All of that. You got to think in whatever world we end up in, it's the America's Cup. You know, it's going to be absolutely evaluated, reevaluated to the nth degree. And I tell you what, I'm not going to be training 20 hours a week to have my equipment not perfect and produce less power than I can. So good. I'm glad someone's looking at it that hard.
Do you have any input into all that? I'm sure you do.
Yeah, absolutely. Like all things Cup, it's about the collaboration between the designers and the sailors. And I've always thought the successful teams in the America's Cup are the teams that between design short and sailors have a triangle that works the best. And if there's a slight wobble in any one of those links between the teams, between those three teams, you're going to have a bit on. And you look at all the successful cup teams from the last, certainly as long as I've been doing it, and there's good synergy between those three groups. So yeah, that rings true always in America's Cup.
All right, final question on the Cyclos. If it was up to Freddie Carr was writing the protocol, would it be arms or legs?
Do you know, actually, having done, I love grinding on boats where I'm grinding a winch. I love grinding on boats where I'm moving through gears on the winch, changing directions, working perfectly with foot buttons to click people in and out to try and put power into where I think the power needs to go as like a main grinder. It doesn't blow me away moving a hydraulic pump with my arms. And quite frankly, Justin, the training for that was stood behind a techno gym grinder in a gym, listening to podcasts like yours, getting the volume in, all about volume, all about time at a low heart rate. And it was mind numbing. Now, the shift where we are now out on our bikes, cycling as a group, you can ride for 6 hours, you can stop for a coffee and a bit of cake. It's really sociable, and it's at my age, it's a completely different challenge. So I loved grinding winches and string lines and spinnaker hoists, but I'm really excited for the new challenge to see where I can get to with this other side of things.
That's a fantastic answer. Love it. All right, let's wrap it up then. Questions for you, short term, long term. What's next for Freddie? I think you've got a little announcement to make.
Well,
we've kind of given it away.
I'm super proud that I'll be re-signed for Ineos Britannia. So going into my sixth cup, my third cup under this syndicate, and my fourth cup with a British team. So yeah. Kind of stepping across when the cup happens in 2024, I'll have done 23 years racing and sailing in the cup, and it only just dawned on me that sort of 2 weeks ago when I had sat down with Ben in the pub in Wimbledon and shook his hand. I've always shaken his hand rather than sign a contract, and yeah, I'm really really proud of that. So really excited to knuckle down and get into what I'm sure will be my final encore as a sailor and give it my absolute best shot. Very privileged.
Your dad must be proud of your career.
I'm sure he is. Wasn't the most academic, that's for sure. I did go to university and whatnot, but he made me go to university. I say he made me. He suggested I go to university because when I was with GBR Challenge as a nipper, he was like, look, mate, if this sailing stuff doesn't work out, you need a degree and a pathway. And I was fairly determined to prove him wrong. And yeah, here we are sort of 23 years later, and I haven't peed off enough people. So I'm still going. I'm like a cockroach. I won't roll over.
Well, it's from my side of things, it looks like an illustrious career. So you're up for another cup. You'll carry on with SailGP.
Yes, bits where I can. Do you know what I'm going to do this year? Is I'm not going to be able to commentate as much on SailGP, which I will miss. But I thank everyone there because I learned so much about live TV, and it's the closest thing, the closest buzz I get to racing a sailboat is live TV. Actually, an opportunity I've got is myself and Stevie Morrison are going to start or have started just a little SailGP podcast that's going to sit in between the events where we're allowed to offer our opinions more on what we feel about the sport, which I'm really excited about. Really Fantastic. Excited about. So that's going to drop in the next couple of weeks, our season previews. Obviously, got to be a little bit careful about talking about the British because they're all my mates and all of that. But other than that, I let Stevie talk about them. And other than that, I offer my opinions. And do you know, I'm trying to be really open-minded and I really am trying to say how I feel. And it might annoy some people, but it's sport. And that's what I'll say to the teams that are involved. If you do really well and sail superbly, we're going to talk you up so much because these sailors are impressive. But on the flip side, if you're underperforming, making mistakes, I think we have to talk about it. So please don't write nasty things under the YouTube videos.
Well, that's no, but I think you can judge a sport or a circuit or whatever it is by the fact that you have independent journalists talking about it, talking about the positives, talking about the negatives. If it all just comes out as PR from the organization, yeah, then there's never a bad day on the water. There's never a bad day on the track.
No, you're right. And we've got to bring out these personalities. We've got to bring out the reasons why people are performing and underperforming. And we've got to be honest. I think sailing in the past, as you said, Justin, has a bit of a culture of, because it's such a small community, you don't want to annoy anyone. And I'm not going to go intentionally and try and annoy anybody, but I just want to be honest with my opinions and try. I look at pundits like Gary Neville and Jamie Carragher for the Sky Sports on football, and they're friends with all the managers now and are friends with a lot of the players, but they're, and like Flatman from rugby, he will be honest about people's performance. And I think that is where we have to go in sailing. We have to be a little bit less vanilla. I'm not going to be controversial, but I think we need to bring sailing up to that level where it's not all brilliant all the time.
Well, I think it's a fantastic idea. I'll help you plug that. Anything I can do to help. So let's start with that. What's it going to be called?
It's called Deep Dive. It's called Deep Dive. So if you search any of your Spotify's, Apple, iTunes, Apple Music, those kind of things, it's called Deep Dive. So if you put in the search engine Deep Dive Sail GP, I think it's getting launched very, very soon. And yeah, it's good fun. And there's a bit of cheeky chat around it all, as you'd expect from Stevie. But it's really good fun, and long may that continue. And we're aiming to bridge the gap in between the events, which I think SailGP needs quite often. They just need a bit more content and continuation of the stories. Like the Racing on the Edge show is brilliant, but as you said, that's very much produced by SailGP and tells a nice story. But I want this to be slightly different to that.
Sounds fantastic. Wish you the best of luck with that. Freddie, I've kept you going for over an hour. We said it'd be an hour. So I just got to say thank you so much. Fantastic insight into the America's Cup world. And it's great to hear more about how you kind of evolved as a sailor. I'm sure everybody will enjoy it.
Well, thanks for having me on, Justin. Like I said, it's these podcasts that I'm sure that many a sailor and certainly the guys in the cup are probably going to be listening to in the next few weeks as they're cycling away or grinding away or whatever it might be. So hello to all those guys on their bikes at home, getting fit.
That's it for this episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast. Huge thanks go to Freddie Carr for such a great interview. Thanks also to all of you for subscribing and listening wherever you are in the world. I'll be back soon with another top name sailor interview. And until then, sail fast, everyone.